way. They decide to fight. They yell, curse, honk their horns, or even chase and attempt to confront the offending driver. Meanwhile, the best option for survival is flight. I've discussed this with people from many different backgrounds, and it always brings the same response. We all agree that if someone is driving aggressively or dangerously, the best thing to do is stay as far away as possible. Yet, a lot of us admit to behaving in the opposite manner. We pursue the other car. Where does that come from? In this situation, there are two options. The first is the initial knee-jerk reaction triggered by our brain, which is out of our conscious control. The second is our reasoned response, which can be brought under control. The first reaction is often called a limbic abduction reaction, or an amygdala hijacking, because it is triggered by the amygdala, a small organ within the brain's limbic system. The amygdala's primary function is to immediately signal the adrenal glands when a fear stimulus is received. It has a secondary and slower connection to the cortex and the other reasoning centers of the brain. It's important to realize that the secondary reasoned reaction is not a voluntary one. Many of us just follow what we have seen our friends and family do, and that can brainwash us into thinking that dysfunctional behavior is the normal or honorable thing. With a bit of effort, you can easily change your secondary reaction. All you have to do is decide you want to change, and then work on it. If you are willing to ignore the initial limbic impulse, you can get your cortex to calm down, take charge, and calm your whole body down. Admittedly, some people have to work harder at controlling themselves than others. It does not matter if you're a hothead by nature or nurture, or both. You can learn to control your secondary reaction, and it's important to do this so you don't end up blowing up at people. Some powerful people, politicians, actors, singers, CEOs, even a book publisher, have ruined their careers because they didn't get their limbic impulses under control. Momentary temper flare-ups can cost you everything. Harvard University neurology professor Rudy Tanzi recommends a 4-step process to handle situations in which we are in the thrall of a limbic abduction. 1. Stop yourself from doing what your initial reaction dictated. 2. Take a deep breath. 3. Become aware of how you are feeling. And 4. Recall a past event that gave you a feeling of happiness and peace. In terms of design thinking, you're breaking down the fight response and looking at it as a problem to be solved, then using ideation to bring you to a better place. These steps bring you into a state of emotional well-being in which you regain control over your behavior. In most cases, you only need to take the first 3 steps to get the situation under control. It takes practice, that is, in terms of design thinking, making prototypes, and if you keep at it every time a negative behavior presents itself, it eventually becomes easier and easier to gain control and stop doing it. In any event, taking a deep breath in any situation never hurts. Use your brain. What about other, less immediate situations? Can these techniques help us respond more positively to a more general stressful state? The answer is yes. If you take time to be aware of your current mental state and then deliberately alter it, you can force your brain into more balanced activities. Eventually, this de-stressing becomes automatic. Various types of dysfunctional behavior are associated with a lack of balance in the use of different parts of our brains. So, for example, pathological eating is associated with the reptilian part of your brain, the brainstem. Narcissistic or overly dramatic behavior is associated with being stuck in the emotional limbic part of the brain. Over-intellectualization is associated with being stuck in the part associated with higher intellectual functions, the neocortex. We can't stop ourselves from getting stuck by practicing self-awareness. In this way, we can train our brains to give us greater sensory awareness, body awareness, and social awareness. This is generally referred to as mind over matter, the main principle behind cognitive behavioral therapy, a school of psychology that believes If we can change our thinking, we can change our behavior. Though it doesn't always work for everyone, it's a method I encourage. No matter what got you to the state you're in, consciously changing the way you think about it can help solve the problem. Your turn. Who am I? What do I want? What is my purpose? Ask yourself each of these questions repeatedly and respond with whatever comes to mind. You can write out your answers in a journal or notebook, or just say them to yourself. Don't overthink. Just answer the questions. It's okay to repeat yourself, and it's okay to say things that don't make a lot of sense. Each question should be repeated for at least 5 or 10 minutes. If you have someone available to work with, you can take turns where one person repeatedly asks the same question and the other person answers. Of course, if there are two people, the questions need to be rephrased. Who are you? What do you want? What is your purpose? I might answer, I am a father. I am a husband. Or, I want to finish my book. I want more time. Or, my purpose is to teach. My purpose is to live. All of these are, for me, on a superficial level. Usually it takes a little while to come up with insightful rather than mundane answers. Do it. You might be surprised with what you come up with and how it contributes to your achievement habit. The effect of this exercise is to get you to devote time to thinking deeply about the meaning of your life. What matters more than your specific answers is that you open yourself to these questions. Doing this exercise generally promotes relaxation, builds internal energy, and nurtures an increased sense of aliveness. Similar benefits can be derived from other types of meditation. Experiment to see which works best for you. I rarely meditate in a formal manner. Instead, I do things that are meditative. I take walks. I ride my bike. I make time to be alone in nature when I need to quiet my mind. Another thing that works for some people is repetitive activities that require little focus. Knitting, crocheting, gardening, and doodling can all be meditative. Or make it even simpler. If you're feeling scattered, you can just take a few minutes to be still and focus on your breathing. Be mindful of each breath. In and out. In and out. Try to make your exhalation last twice as long as your inhalation. Pay attention to a fixed object around you. Books, a picture on the wall. Don't analyze, just ground yourself. Ultimately, you will benefit from increased concentration, decreased anxiety, and a general feeling of happiness. Right and wrong. In life, we will often find ourselves playing the game of right and wrong. The rules seem quite simple. I win if I am right, and you are wrong. I once had a heated disagreement with my wife, Ruth, about something silly just as I was leaving to walk over to my friend Doug's house. As I was walking, I was consumed with thoughts of how right I was and how wrong she was. She was worse than wrong. She was downright pig-headed and stupid about it. I was consumed by such thoughts for about 2 blocks. And then I looked up. It was a beautiful, clear winter day, and the bare trees had a fantastic presence. I was awestruck. I felt a surge of wonderment and joy. Still consumed by my feelings about the argument, I shook my head and descended back into my self-righteous annoyance. I put my head down and kept walking and thinking about how stupid she was being. Then I looked up again, allowed myself to experience the wonderment, and again shut it down. I couldn't seem to let my feelings go. Finally, enlightenment came. By continuing to play my solitaire hand of right and wrong, I was being downright pig-headed and stupid. The world was offering me a magic moment, and I was turning it down. With that realization, I was able to laugh at my stupidity and enjoy the moment. I arrived at Doug's house in a euphoric state. That incident took place over 20 years ago. I have no memory of what the argument was about, and each winter I again feel the wonder of that experience when I look up at the bare trees. This whole situation is kind of like gambling in a card room. The room gets its percent off the top the minute you start to play each hand. That's how it makes money. Clearly, regardless of whether you win or lose specific hands, at the end of the night, the player's total worth will have been diminished. It's the price of playing. If I had continued playing the right and wrong game that day, I would have lost a peak experience, and the card room would have gotten much more from me than its usual fee. Whenever I find myself challenged to a game of right and wrong, I stop playing. Next time you find yourself playing right and wrong, remember, you give everything in your life its meaning, so you can choose to end the game. It does not matter how right you are or how wrong they are. You lose just by playing. Similarly, you can modify the way you react to experiences. One little trick is that by exaggerating your reaction, you can make the experience better. For example, if you are at a boring meeting, just tell yourself that it's the most boring meeting you have ever attended. It is, in fact, so boring that it is amazing. If you are depressed, don't get depressed at the idea of being depressed. Get off on it. Admire the fact that you are having this amazing depression. It's the opposite of wallowing. It's allowing yourself to become amused by the terribleness of your situation. You know how some dogs are so ugly they're cute? This is like that. Think of the metaphors a comedian would use to describe just how bad the meeting is. Write your troubles into a comedic country song. Deliver your own stand-up routine about depression. It's incredibly empowering to realize that you have the power to change your attitude toward anything. Do you hate washing dishes? If you think about it, there is a lot that is nice about washing dishes. Putting your hands into warm water is soothing. Rinsing and soaping can be a pleasure. And getting rid of a mess and admiring your clean kitchen is always satisfying. Try out a new attitude toward dishwashing. You might just find enjoyment in it. Once you learn that it is possible to change your habits and develop new attitudes about things, you have a new tool to use in both your professional and your personal life. For most people, it is probably easier to change their attitude toward dishwashing than their attitude toward depression. Yet, if you start with the small stuff, you will find it easier to tackle the harder stuff in life. Reasons are bullshit. Chapter 2. Obviously, the truth is what so. Not so obviously, it is also so what. Werner Erhard. The problem with reasons is that they're just excuses, prettied up. I always used to be late to the board meeting of Working Machines, a corporation located in Berkeley, an hour from where I live. Invariably, after a frantic hour of aggressive and dangerous driving, I would arrive with an apology, explaining that the highway was unusually congested. The board chairman always graciously assured me that the main thing was that I had arrived safely. Still, I had held things up, and the other board members, who had arrived on time, were clearly not thrilled. Deep down, I knew that the highway traffic was not the real issue. Yes, the traffic on Highway 880 was often heavier than I had hoped it would be, and the traffic getting out of Palo Alto and into Berkeley was excruciatingly slow. Yet how unusual was heavy midday traffic, really? I merely failed to allow enough time. I tried to leave earlier. Yet I would always squeeze in a few last-minute emails and phone calls. Then, after leaving my office, I would see a colleague at the elevator and get caught up in a discussion. It all came down to this. I did not see the meeting as a high priority in my life. It was that simple. It had nothing to do with the traffic. Although there were no negative business consequences, it was bad for my self-esteem. I felt guilty for always being late. I didn't like how it felt to have all eyes on me for the wrong reason when I walked into the room. I gave it some thought and realized that there were other people in that room facing the same traffic and the same life happens stuff that I was. Yet, they managed to be there before me because they cared enough to do so. Once I had that insight, I decided that from then on, I would give the meeting the priority it deserved. Thereafter, I gave the meeting the attention it required and left early enough to get there on time. No more last-minute emails or phone calls. No cutting it close. I stopped waiting until the last minute and decided that it was worth it to stop everything else early and get in the car 10 minutes before I had to. If I was lucky and the traffic was very light, I had time to enjoy a little of the Berkeley scene before I went into the meeting. If traffic was normal, I was a little early and could schmooze with some of the other board members. If traffic was really ugly, I was just on time. The positive effects of eliminating the stress associated with getting to the meetings on time were life-changing. And it didn't end there. I began to change my attitude toward time overall. I used to be late to most things in my life. Now I'm known as the pain in the ass who is always on time and expects others to be. I make it a point to start every class and every workshop session on time. It turns out that my life works better when I don't need to come up with reasons for why I'm late. Our society loves reasons. Perhaps the illusion that there is a single known reason for each thing we do is comforting. Unfortunately, the world doesn't work that way. There's the story of the man who is standing in the middle of Times Square in Manhattan, snapping his fingers. A woman comes up to him after some time and says, "Pardon me, sir, why are you snapping your fingers?" He replies, "I am keeping the tigers away." She says, "Sir, except for the zoo, there's not a tiger for thousands of miles." "Pretty effective, isn't it?" he says. This joke uses what is called a causal fallacy. The fallacy comes because the finger snapper mistakenly believes that correlation implies causation. This is just one of several logical fallacies in which two events that occur at the same time are taken to have a cause and effect relationship. This version of the fallacy is also known as cum hoc ergo propter hoc, which is Latin for with this, therefore, because of this, or simply, false cause. A similar fallacy, that an event that follows another was a consequence of the first, is described as post hoc ergo propter hoc, which is Latin for after this, therefore, because of this. Reasons are bullshit. I know it sounds harsh. However, it's a good categorical stand to take, as you'll see. Reasons exist because if people didn't explain their behavior, they would seem unreasonable. So, we are faced with a paradox. We need reasons so we appear reasonable. Yet when we use reasons, we are not taking full responsibility for our behavior. Let's say I walk up to a stranger and punch him in the face. He'll ask why I did that. If I say, "For no reason," I am clearly unreasonable. If instead I say he reminds me of the man who abused my sister, I am now a somewhat reasonable person. Reasons are often just excuses, however. We use them to hide our shortcomings from ourselves. When we stop using reasons to justify ourselves, we increase our chances of changing behavior, gaining a realistic self-image, and living a more satisfying and productive life. Many reasons are simply excuses to hide the fact that we are not willing to give something a high enough priority in our lives. For example, a student might come into my class late, saying, "I'm sorry I'm late, I got a flat on my bicycle." Even if it is true that her bicycle has a flat tire, the bottom line is, getting to class on time is not a high enough priority in her life. If I had a rule that any student who came in late would fail the class, she would have made sure to be on time, flat tire or not. If the rule was you got expelled from school for a single lateness, she would have been there even earlier. A good reason. In the design group at Stanford University, most colleagues have participated in my workshops, and they all know how I feel about reasons. So anyone who starts to give reasons at a meeting, say, for example, "I could not do that because the dean," is often treated to a sarcastic chorus of, "That's a good reason," after which He gets a bit embarrassed. However, he has received, as a gift, the insight that the dean is not the reason. Letting go of the need for reasons to justify your behavior is useful in every part of the design thinking process. It can get you unstuck from dead ends and lead to new approaches and insights. Your turn. This exercise ideally involves a partner, though you can do it alone, playing both roles. One partner gives a statement, starting with, "The reason I," and the other partner responds, "That's a good reason." Do this for about 5 minutes, then reverse the roles so that the second partner starts the conversation with, "The reason I," and the first partner now affirms each such statement as being a good reason. To get the most out of this exercise, use your current behaviors. For example, this morning I might say, "The reason I am writing this book is that I want to share my knowledge." My partner would respond, "That's a good reason." Then I would say, "The reason I am tired is that I got up too early." My partner would respond, "That's a good reason," and so on. You won't have to search within your answers very long to find the bullshit. If you find that you resist the idea that all your reasons are good reasons, it will be useful for you to think of several additional reasons for each behavior. Many factors contribute to a given behavior, so the entire concept of emphasizing one particular reason for something becomes muddled. In assigning relative importance to our reasons, we introduce a lie into our analysis. We add a high weighting factor to the reasons that most support our version of the story or our self-image. Sometimes people hide behind heart-wrenching reasons. It's important to understand that this doesn't make them any more useful. Steve, my oldest son, was born with cerebral palsy, which in his case meant both mental retardation and muscular spasticity. Although he has a tough time doing things that others find easy, he could manage most everyday things. When his mother reprimands him for bad manners, such as not using a knife to cut his food, he gets angry and says, "I can't help it. I was born that way." Whenever he says that, my heart goes out to him. Still, it is in his best interest to realize that he is giving us a good reason. Reasons and their complications. Studies have shown that people are selective when it comes to recording what really happens to and around them. No matter how strongly you feel you have the true picture, you're probably wrong. You can't know the reason for anyone's behavior. To complicate matters further, sometimes we are actively dishonest about the reasons for our behavior. A classic example comes from a Japanese professor in one of my workshops. He claimed he wanted to spend more time with his family, but he was too busy at work. When I asked a few questions and elicited some details about his daily activity, it was clear that he wasted a lot of time at work. He chose to stay late at the university, socialize with his colleagues during the evenings, and then appear macho by having it known that he went home later than everyone else while receiving sympathy for not being able to spend more time with his family. Clearly, he had made a choice, and being too busy at work was, of course, bullshit as a reason. This was immediately obvious to everyone in the workshop, yet it took me a full half hour to get a glimmer of recognition out of him. Things happen. We do things, and others do things. If you like what happens, keep doing what you are doing, and hope it keeps working well. If you don't like what happens, do it differently next time. Reasons get in the way of this simple, pragmatic approach. We are far better off without reasons. They provide people with excuses to keep behaving dysfunctionally. The world would be a much better place without reasons, right? Okay, yes, not having reasons would lead to a strange existence. Without reasons, you would look like an unreasonable person to everyone else. So where does this leave us? I have a twofold approach to the problem, one for the external persona and one for the internal self. Externally, you use reasons in everyday conversations when you need to, and thus appear to be perfectly normal and reasonable. internally, you look at the reasons your external self offers and question each of them. The internal self also looks at the reasons given by the people you are interacting with. Simply by noticing how reasons are used, you can gain insight into your own behavior and your relationships with others. This approach works well to change your own actions. It can't be used to change others, however. It's not your job to tell anyone else her reasons are bullshit, unless she is actively seeking your advice, like taking your class or, say, listening to your audiobook. Doing this would make you a pretty unlikable person, pretty quickly. The best way to fix the world is to fix yourself. As I always caution my students and workshop participants, do not try this on anyone else at home. Make a pact with yourself not to use reasons unless you have to. This is actually an incredibly empowering position to come from. Be confident enough in your actions not to need to explain yourself. Trust yourself and act. I get a lot of requests from students around the world who want to join my research group at Stanford. If I know I will not accept them, I simply thank them for their interest and say I am sorry that I will not be able to accommodate them. This invariably ends the conversation. I get at most a thank you note. However, if I justify my action with a reason, then the conversation drags on as the student attempts to work around my reason. In the past, I have given a bullshit reason. It feels like I'm being nicer somehow. Sure, it may be true that I'm too busy, or going on sabbatical soon, or whatever else I've told the student. Yet if I felt strongly enough about that person, I'd make it happen. In truth, it is difficult to think of a good reason I could not work around if I really wanted to. Actions speak louder than reasons. Don't give reasons unless you have to. Saying the opposite. Often we say the opposite of what we really mean when faced with beliefs or behavior we find troubling. I recall a very aggressive young colleague of mine who had developed a grievance against a prestigious and long-standing robotics conference. He launched a new conference meant to be in direct competition with the original one. When I asked what his motivation was, he said, "The last thing I would want to do is undermine the existing conference, but there is a need for a new conference." It had not occurred to me that his motivation was to undermine the existing conference until he said that. Once he denied the unmade accusation, it was clear that undermining was indeed what he intended. He had projected his own guilt onto me in the form of an accusation that I had never made. Have you heard the expression, "he doth protest too much"? Often, if someone goes to great lengths to tell you that he is not a liar, a crook, a troublemaker, or green with envy, he probably is those things. I am sure we all have, at one time or another, said the opposite of what we mean. And let's face it, as much as we like to convince ourselves that our motives are pure, we are generally most concerned about ourselves. To keep this in check, do a reversal in your head. Anytime you or someone else gives a motive for behavior, just substitute in your head the opposite of that motive. So, for example, if you say, "I am telling Kathy what her coworker said about her for her benefit, not mine." Try out the reverse motivation in your head. "I am telling her for my benefit, not hers." Often, you will find that this is your true motive. Projection. Projection is a common response. It happens when someone attributes a feeling or trait to another person, when it's she herself who owns that particular trait or feeling. Although psychologists usually use the term projection to connote a negative behavior, projecting both the positive and the negative aspects of ourselves onto others is an important part of life that can be a major influence on our interactions with others. It is the experience of seeing traits in others that helps us to see them in ourselves. If you notice a flaw in another person, it probably means you've had that same flaw yourself. Projection colors almost every aspect of interpersonal relations. A genuinely naive, truthful person will think all people he encounters are truthful. A person with a background of duplicity and dishonesty tends to be wary of others because he projects his own manipulative behavior onto them. Once we project a behavior onto others, it gives us a good reason to think we know what accounts for their behavior. As you now know, I cannot stand to be late because lateness is an issue in my life. So I assume that others share the same concern. When people are late, I cannot understand how they could be so irresponsible. However, only after I became obsessed with being on time did I even notice lateness in others. Your turn. One way to see how prevalent projections are is to make a list of things that bother you about other people in your life. Then take these same things and think about how they appear in your own life. For example, I'd say, I hate how my son Elliot bickers with his friend Claudia, since, not surprisingly, I hate how I bicker with my wife. There are countless things to like or dislike about people. That I chose to mention bickering first says something about me. It tells me that bickering is such an important issue to me that I project my feelings about it onto my son. Realizing this provides a great tool for self-awareness, and such insights make us more empathetic about others' difficulties. Self-hatred plays a large part in this aspect of our personalities. In Chapter 4 of The Adjusted American, the book I mentioned earlier, Snell and Gail Putney explore this concept. They wrote, "Men hate in others those things and only those things which they despise in themselves. It is possible to disapprove of other people in a rational and dispassionate manner. However, to hate them is an irrational and impassioned act. The passion betrays the underlying self-contempt. The origin of hatred lies in the individual's attempt to disown certain potentialities of the self." In other words, if we sense, even subconsciously, traits within ourselves that we would rather not acknowledge because they are alien to our self-image, we deny their existence and project them onto others. Thus, our hatred of others is really the hatred of our own unwanted or feared capabilities projected onto them. To get beyond the self-destructive effects of hatred, it is necessary to be able to accept a basic truth about ourselves. We are all potentially capable of any human act. Love and marriage. Projection also plays a large role in Putney and Putney's provocative assertion that marriage for love is a bad idea. Put in our terms, they're saying that getting married for love is a good reason. For many of my students, this is a version of the aforementioned yellow-eyed cat story. They have all been brought up with the notion that marrying for love is not only desirable, it's also one of life's highest possible attainments. A friend once told me he was in love with falling in love. I knew what he meant. It can be a great feeling to fall in love, especially if your love is reciprocated. Incidentally, when he did eventually marry for love, it turned out to be a disaster. The problem is that people often confuse love with marriage. Falling in love is heavily reliant on projection, while a sound marriage is relatively free of projection. Just as hatred is the result of projecting our own negative qualities onto another, love is the result of projecting our own positive qualities onto another. What we fall in love with are the qualities that we wish we had or qualities we have and wish to share with the other person. Usually, these admired qualities are at variance with our self-image, so we avoid consciously possessing them ourselves and instead project them onto another. In time, these idealized projections are worn away by life's realities. Any marriage based mainly on projected qualities is bound to flounder. A successful marriage results when both partners can just be happy being who they are, and in doing so, add to the enjoyment of each other. As Putney points out, each is seeking candor and warmth, and the exploration of self-potential, sexual capacities, and many others, all of which is facilitated by cooperation of someone else engaged in a similar development. Such persons are not preoccupied with being loved or with maintaining romantic illusions. They are trying to enjoy life together. Love is the ultimate unreasonable activity. When asked why you love your significant other, you might say, "She's smart and has a great smile and is kind to animals." But clearly, those reasons are only half true. You could find lots of women who are just as smart and who have great smiles and also love animals. Why don't you love all of them? No one knows exactly why he falls in love. The Putneys call it projection. You can call it chemistry or fate or whatever you want. You're drawn to whom you're drawn to and attracted to whom you're attracted to, and whatever reasons you give yourself are probably bullshit. I used to look down on the institution of arranged marriage. Surprisingly, my attitude changed completely when I visited India and spent time in the homes of the people there. I saw just as much, or more, genuine affection between husbands and wives there than I did in America. I now feel that young Indians are quite lucky to have a culture where people who love them and know them well set about to assist them in finding suitable marriage partners. The idea that marriage is a joining of entire families, not just two isolated people, is also very attractive. It is not a perfect system. There can be compulsion and ulterior motives on the part of the parents. In my experience, however, that is rare among educated families. If both parties are given veto power, then I believe the system is in many ways superior to online dating and the bar scenes that seem to be the major options these days for single people in America. The basic difference is that in America, a man marries the woman he loves. In India, a man loves the woman he marries. Decision and indecision. When you make a decision about something, you always need a good reason. It's easy to agonize over even the smallest decisions. My wife and son are incredibly indecisive. My son always waits until the last minute. His mindset is, why commit before you absolutely have to? A better opportunity may come along. It may work for him. However, it is tough on the people around him. My wife sees the negatives in every option, so is reluctant to choose something that is not perfect. My wife and son are victims of the Buridan's ass paradox, named after the 14th century French philosopher Jean Buridan, and based on an old fable about a donkey that dies because it cannot make a rational choice between two equally appealing alternatives, eat hay or drink water. This fable has given rise to the Buridan's ass method, in which the decision is based on eliminating the option that has the most negatives so that you don't end up like the donkey. My wife has essentially reinvented this method, whereas my son is often in danger of starving to death by virtue of indecision. I still chuckle over the time I was in France and came to a T intersection. The sign pointing to the left and the sign pointing to the right both had the name of the same village. I pulled over and spent many minutes, brow furrowed, wondering whether to go right or left. Of course, in the end, it didn't matter which way I went. Both roads led to the same place. We would all do well to remember the old saying, if you don't know where you are going, it doesn't matter which road you choose. Making important decisions only after due consideration is a good way to live one's life. However, people often let the agony of deciding go on far too long. Like the fabled donkey, they have all the relevant information, yet they can't decide. In advising my students on making a big life decision, I find that after they've laid out the problem in question and we have discussed the pros and cons of each option, it's best to introduce what I call the gun test. It's very scientific, you see. I point my fingers in the form of a gun at the student's forehead and say, "Okay, you have 15 seconds to decide, or I'll pull the trigger. What's your decision?" They always know the answer. Even if they don't ultimately take that path, this exercise usually releases the pressure built up around the decision-making process and gets them closer to a resolution. I've named another tool I use the Life's Journey method. If a student presents a problem with two possible paths to a solution, I ask the student to take one of the choices and then imagine what life would look like as a result of that choice. It might go something like this. Student: Okay, I decide to go for the PhD. Me: Then what happens? I get the PhD. Great. Then what happens? I graduate and get a job as a professor. Great. Then what happens? I get married and buy a house. Great. Then what happens? I have children. Great. Then what happens? My children grow up and get married. Great. Then what happens? I get older. Great. Then what happens? I die. Then I ask the student to imagine her life if she took the other path. It might go like this. Student: I would leave school after my master's degree. Me: Then what happens? I get a job in industry, or I start a company. Great. Then what happens? I make a lot of money. Great. Then what happens? I do the marriage, kids, house thing. Great. Then what happens? I get old and die. So the end is the same. No matter what path you take, in the end, you die. The point of this is to get people to realize that there is no way to know where a decision will lead. The best way forward is embedded in the design thinking methodology. Manifest a bias toward action, and don't be afraid of failure. I believe it serves people best in life to accept that decisions are part of the process of moving forward, and that there are so many variables that it's a waste of time to try to see the end game. Once we realize that most decisions are not life or death, we can make them without undue stress. Now, much of this flies in the face of decision analysis theory, which presents analytical methods to make good decisions even in the face of imprecise information. Unfortunately, for decisions on personal matters, quantitative tools can be inadequate to capture the subtleties and thus yield misleading conclusions. Many years ago, I was living in India, in the guest house of the Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore. Kumar, a young engineer who visited me every few days, told me that he was leaving and would be gone for 3 weeks. He'd be taking the train to his native village in the north to choose a bride. His family had located 6 eligible candidates, and he was going to meet with them, decide who was the most suitable, and marry her. A month later, Kumar reappeared, carrying a rolled-up window shade. When he unrolled it, I saw that he had crafted a large and complex weighted decision table, a standard tool used in decision analysis theory. On it were listed the names of the 6 prospective brides, each row representing one of the women. Each of 7 columns was headed by an attribute he was most interested in. Each woman had been numerically rated for each attribute, from 1 to 10, and each of these numbers was multiplied by the weighting factor he'd given that attribute, according to what he deemed its relative importance. The 7 weighted factors were chosen so that they would add up to 10. If he had rated the attributes equally, all the weighting factors would have been 10 divided by 7, which we can round off to be approximately 1.4. The column at the end showed the sum of the 7 numbers in that row. The woman corresponding to the column with the highest total, the 2nd woman in the table, would be the chosen bride. Very rational. Just what I would have expected from a good engineer. However, the more he told me about his meetings with the women, the clearer it became that this was not as rational as he pretended. There were 2 major departures from objectivity. First, of course, was the fact that the scores that he gave each woman were totally subjective. Second was that he was not completely honest with himself about his weighting factors. For example, he told me he gave wealth a low weighting factor of 1 because he didn't care about his wife's wealth. Yet he weighted family twice as high. When I asked what he looked for when he rated the family, his answer told me that he was looking for things that indicated that the family was wealthy. The most confused of all seemed to be the ratings for career. Kumar told me he definitely wanted his wife to have a career and not stay at home, and he also wanted her to be available to take care of dinner if, at the last minute, he decided to invite some of his work colleagues to his house. So he gave this a low weighting of 0.9. When all was said, it was clear that he had fudged the numbers in favor of the woman he felt most connected to during their short meeting. So much for analytical thinking. As it turned out, intuition worked just fine. Kumar and his wife have been happily married for over 25 years. Decision-making has become a big business, and new tools are being developed all the time. All of them, however, rest on a belief and a value system that require logical, systematic thought. This approach appeals to people who are naturally judgmental and value so-called rational thought. If he could deliver good decisions at most of life's crossroads, he would be terrific. Unfortunately, it often can't. In my experience, quantitative methods and feelings both have their places. I tend to be pragmatic, and I don't discount my intuition. If a tool gives me good answers, I use it. In either case, when making decisions, it couldn't hurt to keep in mind Captain Ahab's realization about his pursuit of Moby Dick. He says, "All my means are sane, my motive and my object mad." The best scientific methods for decision-making won't help if your question is one that can't be answered rationally. Ahab was following a logical course of action, but he was doing that in pursuit of something irrational. Make sure that your motive is a good one before bothering to figure out how you'll find an answer. Don't listen to your professor. I had a PhD student from Bulgaria whose father was a well-known professor, and the student had led a fairly privileged life in his country. He was very bright and inquisitive. After a while, he started asking me questions about things in this country that confused him. For example, in Bulgaria, there was one nationwide price for gasoline. He could not understand how some gas stations in the United States could charge more than the others and survive. He asked, "Wouldn't everyone go to the least expensive station?" At the time, I didn't really know the answer to that question. Of course, now that I have the D-school mentality, I would probably tell him to go ask the people buying gas at the expensive stations. Regardless, it was fascinating to see America through his questioning eyes. Then one day he came to me with a serious problem. He had begun to realize that it was impossible to do lots of things without a credit card. He couldn't rent videos or a car, and many places would ask for a second form of identification, which he didn't have. The problem was that he couldn't get a card unless he already had credit. I decided to let him apply for a joint card with me. The deal was this: I would not use the card, and paying the bill would be his sole responsibility. We received two cards in the mail, and I destroyed mine. A few days later, he came to me with a mailing he had received. As a bonus for applying for the card, we were eligible to buy a packet of tickets for the Canadian Lottery in British Columbia. For only $20, we had the chance to win valuable prizes. He asked me what I thought. I gave him my best New York streetwise explanation of what a sucker play it was. I told him to throw the offer in the garbage. Furthermore, even if it was an honest offer, he was certainly smart enough to figure out how ridiculously poor the odds of his winning were. Certainly, these were good reasons not to do it. Close your eyes and imagine the end of this story. Got it? Okay. Here is what actually happened. He sent in his $20, and he won the grand prize, a luxury car or $80,000 in Canadian money. He took the money, which came tax-free because he was an alien. He and his fiancée used the money for their wedding and for a down payment on a house. They soon had children, and they are now living happily ever after in California. This is yet another time I'm glad someone did not listen to my rational voice of experience and expertise. I guess when it comes to the accidents of real life, not even professors know much. The point of the story isn't to ignore all advice. It's that you have to live with the consequences, good or bad. Do something or don't do it. Follow advice or ignore it. In making your decisions, keep in mind that even when the odds are against you, you still might win. Life is a gamble, and ultimately you have to decide for yourself. Who's really stopping you? If there's something you really want to do, often it's as simple as just doing it. Remember, I am talking about the real stuff, not pipe dreams. In the end, you don't need tricks or gimmicks. It comes down to the difference between trying and doing, between talking about it and acting. And ultimately, it depends on the double bottom line, which is intention and attention. Do you really intend to do it? Are you willing to give it the attention it requires? If so, then you simply need to start. In design thinking parlance, it's time to enact what we call the bias toward action and determine how you can move toward your goal. Let's say your goal is to write a book. Checking Facebook 5 times a day is not getting your book written. Talking about your writing is not getting your book written. Texting your friends, well, you get the idea. Even joining a writer's group or going to a writer's conference isn't going to get you there. What gets you there is putting your butt in the chair and your fingers on the keyboard for extended lengths of time. You need to commit to write, even if the first draft comes out terribly. When I set out to write this book, I began by waking up earlier so that I could get in some writing time before my wife Ruth awoke. Even when that meant I got very little sleep, I did it anyway. I took a few days off here and there, but they were the exception. The rule was that I was there at my computer, showing up each morning until I had finished. I chose to make it my priority over anything that might distract me from it. When people talk about who's stopping them from achieving their goals, it's often a critic. A family member might once have said something thoughtlessly insulting. A teacher might have given you a bad grade. A former boss might have thought you were a dunce. Yet none of these critics can actually stop you. Nor do negative people deserve any spot on your path. Even if they have stolen your keyboard and broken all your pencils, they don't have any actual power to stop you. In reality, no one's usually trying to prevent us from achieving our goals. The situation is most often like that brilliantly portrayed in the British TV series The Prisoner. Throughout the series, the hero, identified as Number 6, is trying to escape from evil people who are working for the villain, Number 1. Finally, in the last episode, he understands the answer to his question, who is Number 1? When he first heard the answer in Episode 1, it sounded like, you are Number 6. Now he understands that the answer to, who is Number 1, is, you are Number 6. He had metaphorically imprisoned himself. As Franz Kafka put it, it was a barred cage that he was in, calmly and insolently, as if at home. The din of the world streamed out and in through the bars. The prisoner was really free. He could take part in everything. Nothing that went on outside escaped him. He could simply have left the cage. The bars were yards apart. He was not even a prisoner. Even when there is a real obstacle, it is possible to get around it. Years ago, my wife Ruth and I were traveling in India, and we changed our departure date via telephone so that we were leaving one day earlier. When we arrived at the Delhi airport at about 2 a.m., the guard would not let us enter the terminal because our paper ticket was for the following day. We explained that we had changed the flight date, but he wouldn't budge. I pointed out to him that the United Airlines desk was within view, and if he allowed me to go there, I could get the date changed on my ticket and come back to show him. He refused. I offered to leave my passport with him as a guarantee. He refused. I offered to leave my wife with him as a guarantee. He refused. I offered both my wife and passport. He still refused. Then, I made a bold choice. I had seen his rifle. It looked like it was old, possibly pre-independence, and likely useless. I figured the chances of it blowing up in his hands were greater than the chances of the bullet actually reaching me. So, I calmly took Ruth's hand and just walked past him. He did not shoot, and I did not look back. Most times, there are no armed guards. We simply stop ourselves. We are Number 1. You are responsible for deciding what you do or don't do, Don't blame others, and don't use reasons to justify or rationalize your behaviors. Although excuses may seem to get you out of difficulty at the moment, in the long run, they are often counterproductive. The issue of time. One of the biggest excuses we have for not getting things done is a lack of time. We all have the same 24 hours.